Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. Welcome to The Naked Englishman. On Tuesday, the 8th of July, on a sunny day, 2025, it's, let's just see, it's probably about 7 or something. Just walking into the kitchen. The cat hasn't come down to be fed yet. Oh, 7:45. A bit later than normal. Had a late-ish night, not too late. Just got up, had a shave and a bath, bathed and all those sort of things. Facing the day for another day. So yesterday was working on my pipe smoking book, which was going very well. Obviously I made the videos and what have you, had some phone calls to do. Overall it was good. I finished. I was reading an R.F. Delderfield book called Diana, which I managed to finish as well, which I was very pleased to get to the end of that. Although it was a very unsatisfactory ending sometimes on Mr. Delderfield's books. Beautifully written, wonderfully constructed stories, but sometimes I do often feel like, oh, you kind of buggered up the end. I don't know if anybody else feels that way. I just felt it was a bit unsatisfactory, really. But everything else about it was interesting. I think it was one of his earlier books, so I was quite interested to see how he wrote when he was not at the top of his game. But anyway, there we are. That was that. Today, I've got Mark Byford on the show to do... Well, it'll go out tomorrow, but we're recording it today. So we're talking, I think, about his company that he's set up, his CIC, which is a community something company. I don't quite understand what that is, so I'll get him to explain it and what they're going to be doing. He's been on tour around with his Fork the System, trying to wake up farmers to the nonsense that's happening. Of course, what we really need is a lot of these farmers to break up their land and offer it to small farmers rather than massive great big farms doing monoculture. I'd love to see many more smaller farms as we once had. And it was like the system had worked for thousands of years. And in the last 100 years, we've seen the change. And as an experiment, I think it's been dreadful. It's something that maybe we've had to go through. I think we probably did have to have a look at, well, what happens when you progress to the nth degree? When you progress to the nth degree, you start saying we don't need food. We'll just create it synthetically, which is clearly not right. And we'll create it in monoculture, which devastates not only the landscape with these massive fields and pulling out hedgerows, but kills off the wildlife and the pollinators and everything else. And that is incredibly bad, and we've seen how bad that is. And it meant that people have got used to having food without any knowledge of how it's produced, where it's produced, what it's made of, the trials and tribulations of producing it. People have accepted different flavours, artificial flavours, of course, with all the preservatives and everything else that's in it. And that's, in my mind, just, you know, terrible. So as an experiment, maybe we've had to have the last 100 years or so to go, we're not going to do that again. We've had to go through the what happens if you have these extreme capitalists who set up big corporations like pharmaceutical companies. And they say, well, in order for us to make money, we need to have the population ill. So we'll continually keep them ill. And the big agricultural companies are in part of that to say, well, we won't grow real food. We'll grow partial food and we'll fill it full of chemicals so people remain ill. They'll go to their doctors. So, of course, the National Health Service, public enemy number one, has to make sure that they don't really help people. Yes, set bones and certain things, but when it comes to other things, they can just keep them plied with chemicals so the pharmaceutical companies can continue to make their money. And we've just seen actually more and more people are ill. They may be living longer. That may be true. And we could ask ourselves, why is that the case? And clearly, that's because we've discovered that actually you need to be a little cleaner in your habits, clean up the water, although, of course, they pollute the water. But don't necessarily draw your water from wells in which an animal has fallen down and is decomposing in it. So you want, clearly you want clean, fresh spring water that is structured by the fact that it's running through mineral-rich soil and rock, and is constantly on the move as opposed to stagnant. So, intellectually now we know how we ought to live, but we're not living that way because of convenience. And we've discovered that being in a town and a city to some degree is useful, but to another degree we've lost the little farms, the little orchards, the animals that would come into market, and they've become too sterile with the tarmac and glass and steel and just token trees as avenue trees. And so we've lost again the connection with the land, and we don't have the farms butting onto those towns supplying fresh milk and fresh produce. And that's clearly part of the experiment that we can look at and say, well, that went wrong, didn't it? That went wrong. We've tried this. We tried to bring everything in and have supermarkets. And then we saw how corrupted the supermarkets were, because they were now in league with the big distributors and were commanding the prices and keeping the farmers having to produce the monoculture. And the whole thing became absolutely eating its own tail, really. And then at some point, they're all going to crash. If people get too ill and can't eat the food, the whole system will come down. And if people die, as they are dying, then the pharmaceutical companies will go out of business, the supermarkets will go out of business, the big agricultural companies will go out of business, and the farmers will go out of business. So all that whole industry is propped up on a myth. Whereas you look at the sustainability, which is a word that's become almost an anathema to me, but you look at that sustainability of small local farms supplying, you need a single farmer or a little family, and they don't need a huge amount of customers. You just need lots of those farmers supplying the town, and bring back some of those vegetable barrows into town, coming round a bit like the old milk round again. They don't have to be in the way that they were done before with the horse and cart necessarily, although that would be very charming. But they could be on milk floats and things. And instead of having to go to the supermarket, your veg, your meat and your stuff comes to your road, and you just come out and get it and what have you. Of course, that's the convenience of that means that somebody needs to be around, and you can't just buy it from the supermarket 24/7, as in some cases you can, and that may be not convenient. But then it might be that you decide, well, what do I need to do actually to have a fulfilling life, and do I want to do a job in which I've got to be there by 8:30, 2 hours travelling before that, 2 hours travelling on the way back, under fluorescent lights all day long? Is that really a very fulfilling life? Maybe there are other things that I can do so that I'm have a better life and have some good food. And anyway, that's my thoughts, really, that we've we've had this experiment and it's blatantly not the best way of doing it. And some people would say, but what do you do? You know, we have to progress. Well, you just look where we're progressing to. A world of digital identification, facial recognition, AI and everything, you know, so that we almost have no use whatsoever. But again, I mean, AI and everything else is a pointless thing unless you've got humans at the end of it wanting to consume. Now, if they kill off the humans, or if they try to say, well, we'll just give them universal credit so they can stay at home and operate these things, in the end, humans will not just be satisfied with that, and it will come to an end, and humans will start to, you know, I mean, the end result is once humans don't have to do anything, they will get bored. And that bored, yeah, some people, a percentage, will continue just to sit in front of a screen and live in a virtual reality life. But I don't think most of them will. I think even the what we would class as the thick or the unintelligent or the, you know, the stupid, whatever you want to say about certain section of society, I think equally they would be bored and they would start doing other things. They would suddenly start to do things with their hands. And so while there's a lot of fear about, oh, we're all going to go into this dreadful situation where we're all going to be controlled, I don't think we will, because I think ultimately the humans rebel. They just, you know, we may acquiesce for the easy thing, but when it becomes so easy, it's absolutely dull and boring, and AI is going to produce a very dull and boring world with everything unchallenging and no conflicts and no sense of achievement and no joy, then I think people will, they will rebel in very small ways initially, and then that'll get bigger and bigger. And so I'm not unoptimistic, but we do have to start things like food. If we want to actually live, we do have to get our food supplies sorted out, and we want more and more of these little farms. And I think you probably don't need more than 2 to 5 acres for a little farm to work. And, you know, if you've got animals, you're going to need a few acres. And then you can supply part of the town, and you have 100 of those around the town. You've fed the town. And also some of those will take people from the town to help do the deliveries, do the growing, you know, have some of the land. They may want to live in the town, in the townhouse, and have a few fields in which they have chickens or cows or whatever, and then feel that they're actually part of a community again, and be a working piece of the jigsaw that makes that community work. And and that's it. I suppose that's where the Biggleswick concept is. It's just sort of returning people back to their roots, really, and how you go about it. So that's that one. So that's what Julia and I want to do, and I think many people do. Well, I know they do, because they email me all the time, and some people will be blessed with bigger plots of land and various bits of equipment, and other people will not want to do that. Some people just want to be self-sufficient, and some people will perhaps only want to operate in one area, like John Cook down at Dora's Dairy. Really, he does have pigs, but his main thing is the dairy and making raw milk, and that's really all he does. He has a little shop so people can come along and access it, but he's not really into growing veg and other things, or growing wheat or corn for bread and things like that. But other people maybe, you know, and that's all very laudable. I think some people will want to do a little bit of everything, and some people will just focus on one thing. But we need more people to be doing that. And of course, an outdoor life is a lot more healthier than an indoor life. And naturally, I've got nothing against those people who do an indoor life, like people who write and paint and make pots and, you know, but I just think these smaller businesses is very much what we want to see, these old crafts, these people making something. I just happened to watch somebody making a bowl yesterday. It came up on the phone, and they were using a pole lathe, and I thought that was interesting, watching this chap make a bowl from a block of wood. And the satisfaction to having made something, and Julia and I know what that's like when we did our spoons. We made our spoons. Okay, I didn't finish mine. We just ran out of time, but that's not to say. But we learnt the basic idea of it, the concept, and the using the hand tools, the knives, and the different types of knives. And it sort of opens up your mind, doesn't it, to what can be done. And rather than just going to the supermarket and buying another wooden spoon, something that you've made and you can be proud of, and you've learnt the skill, and you've used your hands, and you've acknowledged it. And if, and of course, down the line, if you concentrated on some of those things, you might even be able to sell them and make a little bit of money on the side. That sort of thing gives your life purpose and satisfaction and pleasure, and you've learnt something. There's no pleasure in just buying something off a shelf that's pre-made with a billion others. My spoon, Julia's spoon, they are bespoke. There's no other spoon exactly like it. They may be similar, but not exactly like it, because it hasn't come off a production line. And that's what makes them unique and memorable and fun. Even if in the end you just put it up as a wall ornament and say, you know, that was me making spoon in 2025 at the Sounds Beautiful Festival, and you've got a little story to go with it, and the Canadian chap who helped you learn about that. All of that, you know, it's encapsulated in that object. Same with the copper sculpting that we did. We both did different types of leaves, and the journey that we took on that was an interesting. It has a little story connected with it. It has a history. When you buy something that's just off the shelf, off the production line, where's the history of one object, and the next object next to it is identical and dull and boring, and, you know, somebody pressed a button, somebody loaded the sheet metal in one end, pressed a button, and this came out, you know, and a million of them are there, and everyone's got the same story. Oh yeah, someone put the thing in, pressed the button, you know. It's no, there's no intrigue, there's no wonder, there's nothing precious, there's nothing fascinating about it, there's no development, then there's no flaws. And the lovely thing about handmade things is there's always little flaws. You know, it might not be symmetrical, for example, or there may have been a knot that was difficult to carve out, or the grain was in the wrong place, or, you know, you chopped your finger a bit, cut your finger when you were doing a certain move or whatever. You know, all of that makes that item so interesting. And we haven't lost it yet, but we are in the process of losing it. And of course, it's not made of plastic. That's the other thing. It's not a plastic spoon, because it will degrade and disappear back into the earth and be part of the earth, and it will then develop into new trees or new plants, and that circle will continue. And while I'm sure that plastics and other things will eventually do that, you may have to wait thousands of years for that to happen, which is an unnatural cycle. It's a cycle, but it's just too long and damaging for the planet. Think of all the landfill of plastics, big old plastic chairs that people have thrown away, and all the sort of rubbish that are in vehicles that are thrown away and crushed up, and in people's houses, all that awful plastic, which will eventually degrade, and after it's leached into the world, and slowly, surely, all of that stuff will work its way out and be a natural thing. But we, you know, you don't want to wait hundreds of thousands of years for that to happen. Whereas my wooden spoon, if I left it in the woodland, by next year or the year after or in 3 years' time, that may have fed a plant that may well grow to be chopped down to be turned into a spoon, you know, within a very short cycle. And as humans, we need short cycles, because we only have so many years to live. and let's keep the planet nice and the environment nice for us to be in, because let's face it, the universe, the source, God, whatever you want to call it, has given us this very beautiful and incredibly well working world in which to inhabit. Let's keep it that way and let's not destroy it. Anyway, there we are. That's the Naked Englishman today. Views on a theme. Till next time, take care and bye for now.